Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So you don't like what you got in your stocking this morning? You're wondering how fast you can get out to exchange it, perhaps. You might want to wait on that until you hear what we've got to tell you. Also, a look back at some of our favorites this past year. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is Christmas Day today. If you were out shopping at the last minute yesterday, a fate I managed to avoid, you might have been able to nab yourself some pretty good deals. Tomorrow might be even better, though. Retailers are expecting Saturday to be about as busy a shopping day as they could possibly hope for. Maybe because they're offering deeper discounts than ever to get all that extra inventory out the door. And never mind all those shoppers returning gifts that are the wrong size or the wrong color or just plain wrong. And on that front, by the by, if you're the person doing the returning, you might want to beware. This has been, as you may have heard, a tough holiday season for retailers. And the post-holiday return season may be challenging, too. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
Here's the dilemma. Most of the time, people return sweaters or new gadgets because it didn't fit or they didn't like it. But sometimes it's more devious. They wear the sweater before they return it, or they've stolen the gadget and they're trying to make a little cash by bringing it back. So some stores have been looking for ways to discourage them. A store might limit how many days you have to bring something back, or return too often and your name might end up on a blacklist. John Long is at Kurt Salmon Associates. It's a retail strategy firm.
Certain retailers, electronics retailers and the like, do have what they call restocking fees.
Basically, it's a charge for bringing something back, so you don't get a full refund. But he says stores are also trying to make it easy for shoppers.
These days, it's our view anyway, that for retailers it's still a tug of war to win more of the customer's wallet, so they have to make every online and in-store experience as pleasant and easy as possible.
Some stores are using the return policies as a way to do that. At Avenue, a women's clothing store in Manhattan, shoppers can bring stuff back until January 24th, and a sales clerk told me no sale is ever final. Felicia King kept coming back to take advantage of that.
You know, my taste is my taste and their taste is their taste. So if I give someone something, I want them to be able to return it if they don't want it.
If you're planning to bring stuff back, resist the urge to open the box. And don't forget the receipt, if you have it. And don't despair. A survey by the National Retail Federation suggests most stores haven't tightened things up too much this year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
'Tis the day after the vote and all through the Congress. Not a creature is stirring, not even a lobbyist. Lawmakers have vacated the premises after a nail-biter of a week. Democrats squeaked out a Christmas Eve win on health care reform yesterday morning. But it is safe to say that the real work starts now, the lobbying and the arm-twisting to get the final House-Senate compromise to be more to this person or that person's group to their liking. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Lobby groups like the National Federation of Independent Business are railing ever louder as health care reform comes closer to fruition, especially since companies with 50 or more employees will pay steep penalties if they don't offer insurance. But Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution says the smallest firms with 25 or fewer employees don't have much to worry about.
Small employers are excused from having to provide their employees insurance.
Plus, they'll get tax credits if they do provide it, and they'll be able to shop on new health insurance exchanges for hopefully cheaper plans. I checked in yesterday with several small business owners I've been following during this debate. I didn't find diehard opposition, more cautious optimism and mild disappointment.
I was so excited last year to think, maybe unrealistically, that we would see a single-payer plan and get away from employer-based health care, but it doesn't look to me like we're getting anywhere.
You know, we've got to start somewhere, and I suppose if everybody is not too happy with it, then probably chances are that we probably got somewhere in the middle and this is going to be a program at work.
That's Christina Runciman of Lifeforce Glass in Kingsport, Tennessee, and Brian England of British American Auto Care in Columbia, Maryland. England has 12 employees. He's especially encouraged by a tax credit to provide health insurance, which he already does at significant cost. But Runciman, whose gift business has struggled in the recession, says a tax credit won't change the insurance equation for her 5-employee operation. She doesn't have enough income to benefit from it. Some entrepreneurs aren't so sure they have time to wait around until key provisions like insurance purchasing exchanges kick in. Stephen Tater is launching a line of retro clothing under the brand name Ohio Knitting Mills.
The legislation that's shaping up in the very long term could benefit me as a business owner. In the short term, I feel it doesn't help me at all. You know, by 2014, my business will be either highly successful or long gone.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing, nada, bupkis. But we're still going to think of something to say when we do the numbers. Back in March, the president's automotive task force took a little trip to Detroit. Members did fun things like drive the new electric Chevy Volt. They toured a Chrysler plant. And they tried to figure out whether Chrysler and General Motors ought to get another $39 billion in government loans. As we now know, two of Detroit's big three did get that money and billions more, loans and direct investments that they are still trying to pay back. But lost in a lot of the talk about the bailouts that Chrysler and GM got this past spring was this. That tied up in the history of Detroit is a history of this country's relationship with credit. On the face of it, GM is a car company. But it was pretty much built on borrowing, our borrowing. And this seems hard to believe 2 years into a credit crisis. But there was actually a time in this country when consumers frowned on going into debt for some of life's pleasures. That began to change about 100 years ago, as Stephen Smith of American Radio Works told us this past spring.
Back in the 1910s and 20s, factories across the country were pumping out an unprecedented wave of new consumer products.
America, industrial miracle of the century. From all the states flow bounteously the products of forest, mine, and field.
This vintage promotional film celebrates the flood of new durable goods pouring over American consumers, like washing machines, phonographs, radios, and refrigerators. But historian David Farber says there was a problem. Big-ticket items were still too expensive for many middle-class Americans, and there was no such thing as Visa or MasterCard.
There was no consumer credit in the beginnings of the 20th century. There were no credit cards at all. So smart entrepreneurs started to think through the problem. How do you get people to buy things that they can't afford with the money in their pocket?
Cash up front was a particular challenge for middle- and working-class people who desired that popular new machine called the automobile. An average family would have to save for about 5 years to buy a car.
Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry Oldsmobile.
The merry Oldsmobile, along with the Buick and the Chevrolet and other cars, was made by an innovative young company called General Motors.
General Motors invented the credit system. They created the modern methods of advertising and marketing. General Motors was really at the forefront of creating, in many ways, what we think of as modern consumer capitalism.
Here's how GM helped spawn the American way of debt. In 1919, GM was trying to catch up with the world's number one automaker.
The little old Ford, it rambled right along. The little old Ford rambled right along. Now,
Henry Ford's Model T was plain, simple, and relatively cheap. It came in one color, black. To buy one, you paid cash up front. GM cars were more colorful and more stylish and more expensive. David Farber says GM gained on Ford by starting a credit war.
General Motors creates automobile loans. 1919, 1920, they create the General Motors Acceptance Corporation. And that allows people to buy more expensive cars by going into debt.
Historian Lendell Calder says the socially conservative Henry Ford scowled at GMAC's auto loan business.
He had older views about whether it was a good idea for Americans to use debt to finance instruments like cars, and he was against it.
Instead of the new-fashioned installment plan, Ford offered customers the old-fashioned layaway plan.
What Ford asked people to do was to bring every week $5, $10 and deposit it in an account run by their local automobile dealer. And then when they had enough money in the account, only then could they take delivery.
Henry Ford thought he knew the American consumer better than executives at GM. But David Farber says Ford couldn't quite see that attitudes about credit and debt were changing.
You had a country in some ways based on the virtues of avoiding luxury, avoiding debt, of being thrifty. And then suddenly in the 20th century, as manufacturers were able to produce so many goods, they begin to wrestle with the possibility, well, maybe it's good to go into debt. Maybe it's good to have luxury items.
Americans gobbled up the newly available credit. By 1930, most durable goods were bought on the installment plan, including more than two-thirds of all automobiles. Soon, Ford dealers were forced to offer auto loans as well. After World War II, the consumer credit business grew at a dazzling pace. By the end of the 20th century, the General Motors Acceptance Corporation had loaned out more than $1 trillion to car buyers. GMAC expanded into home mortgages and other kinds of credit as well. Historian David Farber says that our modern way of buying and borrowing owes a debt to Detroit.
Bottom line, when I look at what General Motors was able to do from the 1920s, at least through the 1980s, it wasn't chrome on cars. It wasn't necessarily a new six-stroke engine. Is that they were inventive, and credit was one of their greatest inventions.
The question now is whether General Motors can reinvent itself. Both GM and its credit arm, GMAC, are struggling with staggering debts. Both companies are running on federal bailout money. They're essentially borrowing their futures from the American taxpayer. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
One of the interviews we aired this year was a little bit different. It was with a guy named Robert Fitzgerald Diggs, probably better known by his stage name, The RZA, and also for the hip-hop group he founded called the Wu-Tang Clan.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all.
In the 15 years or so since Wu-Tang started, The RZA has become an entrepreneur, a platinum-selling solo artist, and in his books, something of a philosopher, too. When we talked to him back in October for our series Taking Stock, I asked him about his second book called The Tao of Wu.
Well, this first book was more dealing with a lot of Wu-Tang history itself and a lot of things relating to the music of the group. And this is more of a personal expression of my life experiences and the wisdom that's gained from it. It's not an autobiography, I want to get that clear, but it's definitely a lot of stories and things in my life. And hopefully it'll help some young people have a better day and a better chance at attacking the society.
Let's do the autobiography thing. I mean, what was life like for you as a kid and as you were starting the Wu-Tang Clan?
Well, as a child, being one of 11 children, it was, you know, very hard times growing up in New York City. Seemed kind of hopeless, but always had faith in my heart and always had a lust for knowledge. And this lust for knowledge led me to learn hip-hop music and learned to express myself, and as I grew into a man, I became like more of a mentor to other brothers, even though I wasn't so much older than them, but they looked up to me for certain things, took my wisdom and listened to it, and I was able to bring together a group of men, put together a band called Wu-Tang Clan, sell millions of records, start clothing lines, and all kind of different Wu products.
Do you ever have any ego problems with these guys?
Well, ego always exists, you know? Ego exists. And we are men, you know? Men, you know, with all that testosterone inside of us, you know, we definitely have friendly competition, sometimes not so friendly. And egos jump out, you know, 1 minute, because at any given moment, any one of us could be the star of the group. Nowadays, Raekwon, the chef, is considered one of the hottest members of Wu-Tang Clan right now with his new album, Cuban Links Part 2. And he lets you know that he's the man right now.
So here you are, 15 years after you started the Wu-Tang Clan. You are successful and rich, and you're doing well, and you've got a great organization behind you. And yet, just to back up to something you said a moment ago, you've written this book, the new book, The Tao of Wu, as a way to get kids figuring out a good way to attack this society. What does that mean?
I like to say that I'm rich. I like to say I'm rich in heart. You know?
Fair enough.
I never really been a money-hungry guy or chasing money, and I probably gave a lot of my money away to the people who needed it more than me, I guess. But what I mean is that, you know, we go through our society, we grow up, a lot of us is underprivileged, and especially in today's, recession, there's a lot of hard times out there for people. And if you think that money is the only cure to your solution, you'll never find a cure. Wisdom is a cure. It's all through perception. I like to say that a man should put himself in heaven at once. Don't wait till you die to go to heaven. Live heaven on earth. You could be in a small apartment inside a project. If you have the right mentality, that project could be a paradise for you. But it's the mentality that we carry with ourselves every day that makes our surroundings uglier than what they really are. For instance, I grew up in a project called Stapleton Projects in Staten Island, right?
Mm.
And it's a very tough place to grow up. You got guns, drug dealers, murderers, and guys will urinate in a staircase and all these kind of things, right? But then I go to California, and there's a place called the Oakwood Apartments. Very similar structures, But it's nice, and everybody's happy, and people's working, and the grass is clean, and there's no urination in the stairway. It's really the mindset of the people that makes the place good or bad.
So what have you learned in the past year? As you look at this economy, and as you look at people suffering, and as you look at people trying to hang on to that wealth that they have or had, I guess, what has that done to your art? How has that affected what you do?
Well, really, I learned balance is important. I was questioning last year before Mr. Obama took the presidency. People was like, well, he's going to raise the taxes, and that means that you're going to have higher taxes because you are above that $250,000 year quota, right?
Mm.
And I was like, well, you know what? If I have to pay a little more extra so others could have a little more food, clothing, and shelter, then let me pay. Because, what you want for yourself, you should want for your brother and for your fellow man. Now, everybody, we don't need things that we yearn for. And I try to teach my children that nowadays more than ever, there's some things you want and some things you need. Let's do what we need and not what we want more. And that alone will help you get through a recession because your eyes want it all. The cake looks good. The coat looks good. The car looks nice. But do you need it? I'm willing to accept that.
But, a lot of hip-hop is about that. It's about the bigger house and the better car and the jewelry and all that stuff. How do you reconcile, your personal attitude with some of what your art and those who do your art have said?
Talking to kids who grew up with nothing, we all dream of a mansion and dream of big cars because we don't have it and we see it others having it. But I think that's actually it's not a good thing to really promote and glorify those things because P. Diddy said in one of his old songs, more money, more problems, yo. And sometimes a simpler life is better for you.
The RZA is the founder and the leader of the hip-hop group called Wu-Tang Clan. He writes books, too. The latest one is called The Tao of Wu. Listen, thanks a lot.
Thank you a lot.
To read a chapter of The Tao of Wu, you can check our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, so you want to buy a turtle dove or some calling birds? How about a golden ring?
Back in the day, I think five golden rings actually referred to golden ring pheasant.
What?
That's our understanding of it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the markets are closed today, so just for fun, we thought we'd throw you another set of numbers. As we rip open gifts from loved ones today, let's think about all that wrapping paper we are potentially wasting. Half the paper we use in the United States goes to wrap and decorate presents and other products. Don't even get me started on the ribbon, people. There are 2.6 billion holiday cards sold every year, enough to cover a football field 10 stories high. More household waste is produced in the U.S. between Thanksgiving and Christmas than any other time of year, about 6 million extra tons nationwide. So before you open that present, make like my mom. Gently pry that paper off. It could be used again next year. You're listening to Marketplace.
Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. How will climate change affect where you live? Go to marketplace.org/climate and click on the map. You'll also find dramatic photos of the impact of climate change from around the world, plus all the stories from our series, The Climate Race.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Already thinking of returning gifts you're getting today? You may want to wait a bit. The National Retail Federation says the week after Christmas is one of the busiest for retailers. On December 28, 1895, Parisians paid admission to attend the world's first commercial movie screening. And Oscar-winning actor Denzel Washington celebrates his 55th birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Merry Christmas.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, usually on our Christmas Day broadcast, instead of the regular numbers, we do a riff on the 12 days of Christmas. PNC Wealth Management puts out something called the Christmas Price Index every year. For 2009, that index is up a little over 1% from last year, coming in at $21,456.56. That's what it would cost to actually buy the partridge and the pear tree and all the rest of that. The index is a tidy way to fill some time on an otherwise newsless day, but our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, asked Sean Cole to do a little shopping around and compare some prices.
Here's my problem. How do you put one universal price tag on, say, five golden rings? Surely it would depend on where you bought them and what carat we're talking about. And that's just the most obvious example.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love sent to me a partridge in a pear tree.
All right, calling McFarlane Pheasants in Janesville, Wisconsin. They sell game birds. Char DeBrew is the person in charge of mature bird sales.
Hello, this is Char.
And a really good sport.
Okay, you want to know what a partridge in a pear tree would cost?
Two things here. PNC's Christmas price index just says partridge, generically partridge, and that they cost $10 a pop this year. Whereas at McFarlane Pheasants,
the price on Hungarian partridge is 13 and a quarter each. But we actually sell two different types of partridge here.
Oh, what's the other kind?
The other kind is the Chukar Redleg partridge. It's a crossbreed.
And do they cost the same?
No, Chukar Redlegs is $11 each, and that price is good through November.
See what I mean? And never mind that you can't even buy a single partridge from McFarlane unless you pick it up yourself. Pear trees get even more complicated.
Well, it really depends on the size.
And the variety. This is Shannon Passmore, by the way, a customer service manager at Willis Nursery in Berlin, Georgia.
They start at $9.95 for a 3 to 4 foot tree.
Would that be sufficient to support a partridge?
Probably not. But if we stepped up to, say, the 6 to 7 foot size,
mm-hmm.
that would be large enough to support a partridge, and it's $54.95.
PNC's estimate? $149.99. And they call themselves wealth managers. With the turtle doves, we were a lot closer. I have them at $25 a piece. The Christmas price index says 56 for the pair. French hens, or mottled Houdan hens, again, depends where you go. I found them for $3.50 a piece on one website, but you have to buy 15 of them. PNC's index says three hens will run you $45. Four calling birds, interpreted by some as canaries. The Christmas price index and I are in sync to the penny on this one. $599.96. And now, the rings.
Back in the day, I think five golden rings actually referred to golden ring pheasant.
What?
That's our understanding of it. That's correct.
This is Scott Soares, Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Agricultural Resources. He says fully eight of the gifts in the 12 Days of Christmas fall under his jurisdiction, or that of his sister agency, the Department of Fish and Game, the six geese.
If you look at what it takes to get a laying goose, then you actually need to have the pair. So to get six pairs, you'd be paying anywhere from $240 to $600 for those laying geese.
And you would need permits for the seven swans, and that costs money. The Christmas price index takes none of this into account. Plus, PNC assumes that the 8 maids of milking would each earn a minimum wage, which is in no way true.
We're looking at about $18 per hour for one milk person to currently milk one cow.
I had to call PNC and present them with my findings. Jim Dunnigan is the point person for the Christmas price index, and I really thought I'd be able to trip him up.
Yeah, I mean, even just to start at the beginning with the partridge and the pear tree, were you talking about a Hungarian partridge or a chukar red-leg partridge?
I believe the chukar.
Oh, yeah?
If I'm not mistaken.
Turns out he's a lot more up to speed on all this than I thought. He knew about the 5 golden-ringed pheasants?
That's correct.
All of it. And the reason that they list one universal price for each of the gifts, he says, is that they poll the same set of vendors each year. The National Aviary, a Philadelphia dance company called Philadenko. So it's really an apples-to-apples comparison. But he did concede my point that the cost of some of these gifts depends on how you shop, especially when I suggested hiring 9 lady students dancing instead of professionals.
Well, maybe we'll have to think about a Christmas price index skinnied up a little bit.
A discount index.
Yeah, I'd say there's 2 ways to do this. More than one way to deliver true love.
And just to finish out the song, Dunnigan says the 10 leaping lords in the index are just guys who play lords in the Nutcracker. The prices for pipers and drummers come from the Musicians Union. Though a fairly prominent drummer told me that not too many of his ilk work for scale.
Could I ask you to play something? That'd be great.
His name's John Ramsey, and he's performed with the likes of Art Blakey and Wynton Marsalis.
You ready?
Yeah.
In Boston, I'm sorry. We need, John is just one drummer. It's 12 drummers drumming, you know, we need more drummers. There we go. This is the Senegalese drum ensemble Rambach at MIT. Actually, there was 14 of them. And yes, they played for me for free. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final observation before we go about what really is a better way to spend today. I brought the kids down to the studio this afternoon. I figured if I had to work anyway, might as well make it a family affair. Stan Van Gundy is right there with me. Van Gundy coaches the NBA's Orlando Magic, who, as it happens, are working today as well. They're in Boston for a game against the Celtics. Before tip-off today, Van Gundy said that he gets that the league makes a whole lot of money from its TV contracts, but he says there are better things to do on Christmas Day than watch a basketball game. So on this Christmas Day, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. The markets are closed today. They will reopen Monday. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, we all hope 2010 will bring some stability to the economy, but a few nasty bits are likely to linger.
Credit card companies will find new ways to annoy their users.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will join you again on this program next week. Have yourself a Merry Christmas.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.